on The Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It's a name that has long been associated on one side of the political aisle or another as an example of extremism for those who defend him, saying that his ideas were right, his methods were wrong, and the other side saying maybe his ideas were right, but mostly they weren't, and his methods were definitely wrong. He has become a symbol of demagoguery. We are delighted to welcome Larry Tye back to On the Bookshelf. We visited with him a couple of years ago when his book on Bobby Kennedy came out, and I reviewed his book, The Father of Spin, years ago. His new book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. It's from HMH Books, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Larry is not only a best-selling author, but previously an award-winning reporter at the Boston Globe, a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He runs the Boston-based Health Coverage Fellowship. Larry, welcome back to On the Bookshelf.
So it's great to be back with you.
Let me tell you, a big book. And just so you know that I've done my homework a little bit, I was delighted that you referenced M. Stanton Evans, Stan Evans, a personal friend of mine, who wrote a book about McCarthy several years ago. And I had reviewed that book and interviewed him concerning his version of that. So I was interested to see that you referenced him a few times. And yet you came up with even more information that he had done, had more resources than I've read anywhere else talking about Joe McCarthy. And the tricky thing, I think, about talking anybody like this who was, by the end of his run, so to speak, the people that had previously supported him were starting to realize that he was an embarrassment and that he was not doing things properly. And the ones that had always disliked him were circling because they saw him sinking. So it's hard to be unbiased about a guy like this. And I think you did a really admirable job in trying to show both sides of Joe McCarthy. So thank you for doing that. It's easy to do a hatchet job on him because he was a very, very good target. And he set himself up for a lot of the whacks. But I thought you did a really good job being balanced and yet showing where he went wrong and what he went wrong doing. So thank you. Thank you for that, Larry. And thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for saying that.
So you got intrigued by Joe McCarthy when you were doing the Bobby Kennedy bio, right?
That's correct. I had interviewed twice Bobby's widow, Ethel, and she talked about Joe McCarthy. She said that while much of America might have considered him a monster, that she thought he was just plain good fun. And her iconic liberal husband, Bobby, got his start working for Joe McCarthy, and the two of them were on opposite political trajectories. Bobby Kennedy starts out working for Cold Warrior Joe McCarthy, and during his political life, he moves increasingly to the left. And Joe McCarthy started out as an avid New Dealer and a big supporter of Franklin Roosevelt's, and he spent his political life moving to the right. And so the idea that the Kennedys thought as highly of Joe McCarthy as they did made me intrigued and made me realize there was a side to Joe McCarthy that I didn't know and that I was eager to find out.
Even at the time that McCarthy first began to be a figure on the national scene, there were people that disagreed with the way that he was starting to run his campaigns. One of the things that you talked about in your book is that he was a legitimate war hero. He really did see combat. He worked in intelligence. He was an officer. Yet, while he was an officer, he was running for re-election as a probate judge back home, right?
He was. So he had he was a Marine Corps hero. He won a dozen medals, and most of the press corps dismissed that. They were so used to his embellishing things that they thought that he was lying about that. And the records I had... the good fortune of being granted access by McCarthy's family to all the personal and professional papers that they had donated 60 years ago to his alma mater, Marquette University. Nobody had ever seen those papers. They were the biggest trove of material on what McCarthy's life and career were really like. And those showed his real-time diary during World War II, and made clear that even though his official assignment was as a land-based intelligence agent, he volunteered to fly missions that took him into a fire zone. He did things that could have easily gotten him killed, and he didn't have to do that. And so we know that he's a war hero, but we also know that Those records show that he was even more of an embellisher and a liar than we had known before in terms of lots of other aspects of his record. So they redeem him in some ways, they damn him in other ways, and in the end we hopefully end up with somebody who's a more flesh and blood, real life person who we understand in a more nuanced way.
I think that what makes him and anybody else who is in this position, who has elevated himself into a position of being judge and jury, as he did with the committee when he was in the Senate, it's important for us to remember that few people are completely without any sort of good side at all. And this does show the pattern of exaggerating. And this becomes one of the more serious character flaws that he has, not only of building himself up, but also of exaggerating the bad side about other people. As you point out, when he's on the attack, someone whose father was, say, a member of the Communist Party for a year and then called on and quit, now becomes a pinko, who then becomes a fellow traveler, who then becomes an actual member of the Communist Party. And there seems to be no end to how far he will go to criticize or to accuse somebody once he kind of gets on... kind of like a dog with a bone. Once he gets on the trail, he refuses to hear anything that might divert him from that, except in very rare cases. Once he starts after somebody, he keeps after him until he either gets him or he's embarrassed by the pursuit.
So well said, and I feel like I've been in training to write this book for a long time. My first book was a biography of a man named Edward Bernays, the father of public relations, who I call the father of spin.
Yes.
And he was a little bit out of control. He never knew where to stop spinning.
Yeah.
Another book was about somebody who grew up not far from where you are in Mobile, Alabama, a baseball player named Satchel Paige.
Right.
And Satchel Paige had one of the most brilliant records ever of a baseball player and certainly of a pitcher. And yet he never knew how to stop spinning his own legend.
Yeah.
And at a point, you weren't quite sure what was true and what wasn't true. And the most out of control of all of them was Joe McCarthy, who, whenever he would start with a grain of truth, you ended up so far from that grain with so many embellishments that by the end, the people who I think he did the biggest disservice to were legitimate anti-communists. That they felt like he was an embarrassment and that he made their whole cause look like it was all based on reckless accusation and exaggeration. There was a real threat from the Soviet Union. Anti-communism had a legitimate point in terms of trying to understand that threat overseas and in our own government. But Joe McCarthy, by pointing his finger at so many people who were not communists, made you think that he wouldn't know a red if he tripped over him.
Right, right. Even Richard Nixon, who started out his career basically in the Congress going after Alger Hiss, for example, at the encouragement of Whitaker Chambers, a former communist who had been converted to Christianity and wrote a book that really laid it all out there. Even Richard Nixon, who was the vice president during part of the time that McCarthy was demagoguing everywhere, knew that he was damaging to not only his own efforts to ferret out the handful of communists that actually were in U.S. government at that point, but that he was just making everybody look like a nut. Anybody who said there are communists in government after McCarthy was suspect.
They were suspect, and Richard Nixon, who was a pretty good embellisher himself,
yes,
basically cut ties with McCarthy and said, this guy is somebody who just doesn't listen to fact and to reason and will never back off. And I think that that his attitude was, if one charge is disproven, rather than apologize or admit that he made a mistake, the next day he would be there lobbing a fresh bombshell. And he understood how the press worked well enough that he knew that if he were to make his reckless accusation an hour before reporters' deadlines, they would never really have time for that first day's page one story to get the other side. And he knew how to play to the vulnerabilities of the press corps. He also knew that the second day story would be, and the correction would be on page 34, whereas his original charges were on page 1, which is where he wanted to spend his life.
Right, exactly. I would say that one of the very interesting points about McCarthy is that he knew how to play the press, and for most of the time that he was in front of the world, he pretty much played them like a violin. Like you say, he knew when the newspapers went to bed, when the stories were going to be put on television and on radio, and he played to all of that. And for a while, they played along. For a while, they were interested. In fact, I've always kind of wondered about this because I, like you, I'm a child of the 50s. I was just a baby when all this was going on, but I've read about him, and it actually starts at a Lincoln Day dinner in West Virginia, and that was the beginning of McCarthy's rise to demagoguery, and he went in with two speeches. He decided to use the one, and when he did, it got such a response, he figured, this is the horse I'm going to ride from this point forward, and it could have just as easily been the other thing. And tell us what was the other idea that he was going to speak on that day.
So he brought, as you say, two speeches in his briefcase to Wheeling, West Virginia. One speech was something he actually knew something about, which was national housing policy, and it was a guaranteed snoozer of a speech. Had he given that speech that night, you and I, 70 years later, wouldn't want to talk about him.
Right.
Instead, he delivered the barn burner of a speech, waving around a piece of paper saying, I have in my hand a list of 205 people in the State Department who are subversives. And the fact was, he had in his hand, he could have had anything in the world in his hand because
right.
He never showed us what he had. It certainly wasn't 200 spies at the State Department because they didn't exist. But he was smart enough to know that in a place, if you were going to drop a bombshell like that, you shouldn't do it in Washington, where reporters might actually know something about how the State Department worked. You wanted to do it when you were somewhere far in an outlying part of the country, like West Virginia, where nobody, these reporters, you know, who are stuck covering a Lincoln Day speech in West Virginia, weren't going to know a damn thing about any of this. And they were the perfect audience to deliver this speech to. And I think that he got what he wanted, which was in 2 or 3 days, he was on page 1 of every newspaper in America. And that was basically, to him, the perfect way of doing what he wanted to do. He was, at that point, in 1950, 3+ years into his first Senate term, on his way to being about the most mediocre senator that you could ever imagine, and clearly facing a huge hurdle in terms of thinking about re-election. So he wanted anything that was going to put him in the spotlight, and once he got that spotlight, for 4 long years, he held it.
As far as the big press people covering him, Fulton Lewis, we had Jack Anderson, we had Drew Pearson. For the most part, were these guys neutral about communism? There seems to be, really, in the book, the idea that they were kind of sympathetic to the idea there may be some, and they were savvy enough that if there was really something to the story, they wanted to be there for the resolution of it. But they began to figure out before long that something was not quite kosher with Joe McCarthy.
Yes, so they were totally receptive. Whether they were liberals or conservatives in that era, both were worried about the Soviet Union, and both were very open to McCarthy's charges if he could substantiate them. But the longer a reporter covered him, and Drew Pearson covered him from the very beginning, unless they were willing to close their eyes and do anything to get on page 1 themselves, they had to admit that his charges just didn't hold up. And unlike politicians that he could intimidate, reporters, and especially powerful ones, Pearson, the most widely read columnist in America, had enough of a base that they couldn't be intimidated by Joe McCarthy, and over time, they, I think in a heroic way, took him on and pointed out his many embellishments and lies. And if you trust popular culture in America, you would think that the Dragon Slayer was a broadcast journalist named Edward R. Murrow. It was a great movie called Good Night, and Good Luck,
right,
where Murrow was seen, portrayed as the guy who brought down Joe McCarthy. Well, Edward R. Murrow himself would have been the first one, and he did admit that he was late to the game, that it was much more mundane, less elegant reporters writing for newspapers who were slogging it out on the McCarthy story for years before Drew Pearson got there, and they're the ones who first pointed out what McCarthy was like. And it took the American people a long time to catch up, but eventually they did as well.
Having read extensively about the 1950s and the Eisenhower years, there's an awful lot that Eisenhower was doing behind the scenes. He kind of propagated this idea of a kindly grandfather as president, and yet I've read a dozen books or so about what a really wise and canny Cold Warrior he was. And he, at first, kind of feels like he doesn't really like McCarthy, but he doesn't go after him. Later on, he shows how really clever a politician he is, that he does an end run around him and manages to help bring him down. But one of the things that always bothered me in retrospect, and it obviously bothers you too reading your book, Demagogue, is that Eisenhower, who had the gravitas and the support, that he could have early on said, "Now, Joe, you got to back it down, or we're going to flatten you," and he didn't.
So he absolutely didn't, and I think that history books have been too forgiving to him. They called his presidency the Hidden Hand Presidency, basically suggesting just what you said, that he looked like a doddering old grandfather, but in fact that he was this wise guy who behind the scenes was pulling the strings and was keeping America on an appropriate course. And I think that's true in lots of things. It's not true when it comes to Joe McCarthy, and people have given him much too much slack there. For the first 2 years of his presidency, his brother, Milton Eisenhower, was whispering in his ear, saying, "Joe McCarthy's a dangerous demagogue, and you should give up a little bit of your popularity. You're the one guy in America who could take him down." And Dwight kept saying to Milton, "No, we've got to let McCarthy do himself in." And that would have been a wise tactic, maybe, if he was a general, and if he were not, you know, he was going to wait until the enemy showed a vulnerability. But in the case of Joe McCarthy, though 2 years that he waited meant lots of people had their lives ruined by his false charges, and the whole anti-communist movement went off in the wrong direction. And I think that by the time Eisenhower finally showed the backbone to take on Joe McCarthy, it was not too late, because it was never too late to take a guy like that down, but he just shouldn't have waited.
Yeah. How is it that the Americans were so taken in by McCarthy? I mean, was it the fear of, that the Soviets, who had been our allies, even with some reservations during World War II, and now they had completely flipped around and they were the evil empire? Is that part of it? Is the fact that there actually were some highly placed communists in the American government, the people like the Rosenbergs that were not in the State Department, but Alger Hiss, for example? There were people that were working against the interests of the United States, but not nearly as many as McCarthy claimed. Why is it that Americans were so in favor of him at first? They didn't seem to be nearly as concerned about his excesses as, say, other politicians or other political leaders were. Why is it that they just kind of took it all in and said, "Go for it"?
So I can give you a justification, but I want to also be straight in terms of how I view what the American public did during those years. The justification is just what you said, that there were real threats out there. The Soviet Union posed a threat. Spies like Fuchs and Rosenberg and those 24-carat spies showed that the Soviets had potential to truly infiltrate our government and to pass on atomic secrets and other things. But that's giving a little bit too much credit to the American public in terms of what they did with Joe McCarthy. The truth is that we had legitimate fear about the Soviet Union, and he was offering an enticingly simplistic solution. "I'm going to go find a spy behind every pillar in the State Department, and that's going to solve the problem." That didn't do anything to remove the Soviet threat. The 24-carat spies were gone, and Joe McCarthy wouldn't have known a spy if he tripped over him in the dark. And the truth is that this is our vulnerability to being taken in by easy answers and by bullies. You can go back to Huey Long, to Senator Theodore Bilbo. You can go to George Wallace from Alabama. You can, lots of people in our history, we've got a strain of this demagoguery that has been there throughout our history, and Joe McCarthy was the archetypal demagogue. He was so transparent about his embellishments and his lies that the idea that it took not just Dwight Eisenhower, but the Senate and the American people, as long as it did, to stand up and say he's wrong, to me, is a little bit of an object lesson on what we ought to be wary of.
Yeah, I think we're far too easily led, especially, like you say, when we're offered a simple solution to a complicated problem. And I, to a certain extent, I blame journalists for that. But on the other hand, you can only do so many four-hour documentaries on the economy that tank before you say, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. I can't afford to get clobbered in the ratings. Let's do something about the sex lives of vice presidents or something.
Yes, and journalists in this case were real heroes, that the McCarthy was dismissing them as peddling fake news. McCarthy was brilliant because when he could charm a journalist, he'd go that route. And when the news was bad and he couldn't charm them, he'd blame the newsman. So he had it both ways, and he was a master at manipulating the press. But enough of the press was out there telling the truth, and people just didn't want to believe it. So I'm willing to point the finger at journalists in lots of cases, but this isn't one.
Now, the Army hearings were his biggest event and the place that he tripped himself up the worst. And I think to a certain extent that one of the reasons that he looked so bad is, and that people turned on him and the journalists turned on him, is not because he wasn't always like that. It's just because they didn't see him in action. They heard or read what he said about himself or what journalists said about him. But when they saw, when people watched him haranguing people, berating people who took the Fifth Amendment and so forth, then they began to realize that, oh, we're not seeing our hero here. We're seeing a bully at work.
So you're right. And I think that it was two things that brought down Joe McCarthy when he took on the Army. One is that the Army was, in a way, the most democratic institution we have in America. People from every small town and generally from every family, especially in the World War II era, had served in the Army. And the idea that truly was an institution that was too big to bully. And Joe McCarthy didn't see that. So when he went the spouting all kinds of charges on subversion at military bases, like the one he really went after, called Fort Monmouth in New Jersey, he went a step too far with that. And that was also something that was going to irritate the heck out of the former World War II commander, Dwight Eisenhower. But the other thing that did him in, as you say, was America finally got to see this guy up close on their television screen. Just about everybody in America was tuning in to listen to him on the radio, watch him on TV, or read about his hearings in the newspaper. And instead of looking like this great hero who was willing to take on powerful institutions, he looked like the town bully, and that's what he was. And America, when it sees somebody up close like that, can call a bully a bully.
Yeah, they dumped him quick. The Senate finally grows some hair and decides that they're going to censor Joe McCarthy. They waited till after the Army-McCarthy hearings, and he basically hung himself, and then they jumped in. But there had been people in the Congress that had been either enabling him or ignoring him for a long time, right?
So there were people in the Congress who enabled and or ignored him for all 4 years of his reign. The people who didn't ignore him and who took him on were watched a blitzkrieg come in and often defeat them in their next race for re-election. So the message was out there that the safe thing to do was ignore him, but politicians are brilliant at reading the polls. They read the polls that showed at the beginning of 1954, when the Army McCarthy hearing started, that he had the support of a full 50% of the American public. By that June of 54, at the end of the hearings, his numbers had gone from 50% to a favorability rating of 34%. That gave the Congress the backbone to take him on, and the Senate condemned him. And when they did, in December of 1954, from then until his death in 1957, 3 years later, Joe McCarthy was essentially all done. Yeah. From the day of his condemnation, it was over.
He dies relatively young. A complicated series of events, not just hepatitis, but aggravated by his alcoholism. But at that point, it becomes a non-story. You know, he's no big deal anymore.
So that is true. And one of the other sets of records that I got to see that hadn't been made public before was all his military medical records from Bethesda Naval Hospital. And they showed that the cause of death listed by the coroner and reported by every journalist in America was, as you say, acute hepatitis. But in fact, it was his drinking that killed him. He started drinking to the point of being an alcoholic almost the day after he was censured by the Senate. And at the end, it was incredibly tragic. He was hallucinating. He had delirium tremens. He died a very sad and lonely death.
You know, Larry, we could talk about your book for another 2 or 3 hours, and we still wouldn't cover everything. There's just an enormous amount of information here and great insight. I think that you would say to us that the legacy of Joe McCarthy is Americans need to quit looking for easy answers to complicated questions and don't be fooled by people who tell us what we want to hear.
I would absolutely say that. I would also say that demagogues, given enough rope, hang themselves, and that's a good news story out of the Joe McCarthy one.
Absolutely. Larry Tighe, our guest today, he is an award-winning reporter and national writer at the Boston Globe, Newman Fellow at Harvard University, now runs the Boston-based Health Coverage Fellowship. His newest book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy, from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's an exciting read. It is a sad thing to read about somebody who did have potential, who did have a good heart, and yet does terrible, terrible things in public. That should be a good warning. Larry, thank you very much for making time to talk to us.
Doc, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you.
Absolutely. Till next time.
Bye-bye.
Definitive biography of the most dangerous demagogue in American history, based on exclusive access to his personal and professional papers, medical and military records, and recently unsealed transcripts of his closed-door congressional hearings. Our thanks once again to Larry Tighe for joining us. Extraordinary book. It is, just to let you know, 481 pages long, and then there is over 100 pages of index, bibliography, and there are also notes scattered throughout the book. It's quite an amazing read. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio stations and hopefully your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.